The investigation took us weeks. We had to fly to literally the other side of the world. We were following digital traces. At the end, ending up in a bedroom in the Netherlands somewhere of some 70-year-old who was still living with his parents. And, you know, there was so much damage. There was financial damage. There was all kind of damage to the company. And his motivation was that he wanted to watch free videos.
Hello, and welcome to Fishy Business, a series dedicated to exploring the lesser-known side of cybersecurity. I'm Alice.
And I'm Brian, and we're colleagues at Mimecast. Every episode, we'll be joined by a special visitor, or in this case, visitors, who are definitely not your average guest, to share tales of risk, reward, and ridiculousness.
We'll be looking for new ways to think about cybersecurity, to learn how we can all improve in the fight to stay safe. Brian, have you ever been in contact with the police when you were younger?
Well, I did steal a car with my brother and my sister when I was 10 years old, but luckily the police actually weren't involved, and it's probably best not to get into the details of that. But it is indeed an interesting question. I know this can be quite impactful on youngsters, especially when they think they've not done anything seriously wrong.
That's why I'm really excited to meet our guest today. We'll be talking about preventing young hackers from enacting potentially damaging events online, or if the harm's already been done, how this can be turned into something good.
Sounds very exciting. We have two guests today from the Dutch and British police forces to show us what interventions are developed to prevent young people from starting or further developing a criminal career. With us today are Fleur Janssen, team leader of the Offender Prevention Squad of the Dutch police, and British offender prevention expert Gregory Francis.
Welcome, guys. Now, before we get into all of this, I'd love to understand a little bit more about your background and maybe how you'd explain your roles or your careers to somebody at a dinner party, for example. Fleur, let's start with you. How would you explain your role at a dinner party?
Well, first of all, I would really like to join another dinner party after all that COVID nonsense. If I would attend a dinner party, I think I would explain it as in our mission is actually to prevent crime, cybercrime, before it happens. And we do that by focusing on offenders and on potential offenders. So on the one hand, we try to deter potential offenders away from cybercrime. And on the other hand, we disrupt offenders who already chose to commit cybercrime.
Wow, that's super interesting. I can imagine sitting next to you and I'd be like, I'd love to delve in deeper. Tell me more. So we'll definitely go into that in more detail. And Greg, what about you? How would you describe your role to somebody at a dinner party?
Not too dissimilar, strangely enough, from Fleur, to deter and divert people who have interest and an aptitude for cybercrime. So and also to look at those who are committed to cybercrime and try and degrade and disrupt them.
That's super interesting. So Fleur, how did you become a cybercrime fighter for the Dutch police? Was there a specific incident and what did you want to accomplish?
Well, before I went to work on cybercrime, I've been working on other forms of crime like drugs, trafficking, human trafficking. And what really struck me about cybercriminals is that cybercrime seems to attract a completely different type of offender. So I am a criminologist, that's my background, and I've always been interested in why people actually commit crimes. So yeah, for hackers and people who commit DDoS attacks, these motivations just seem to be different. It's just different people. So I was just really interested in what kind of people are attracted by these new forms of crime that we as a society more or less created. Because a lot of offenders who end up committing cybercrime don't really do it because they are into malice or money, as Greg always puts it. They do it because sometimes they are not aware of the fact that it's actually illegal, because they are exploring, they are experimenting, because they know it's bad, but they might not know that it's actually against the law. So there's a really different range of motivations why people actually commit crime. And that's just different than for other types of crime.
Absolutely. And Fleur, I think you've made a load of really good points there. And I've been noting down questions because I've got more questions off the back of what you've said. But Greg, I think we'd also really love to understand your background, you know, your history, where you came from. Maybe if we start, you know, how you came to being in the police and then developing into your current career, because I'm sure we've got listeners thinking, wow, that sounds really cool. I want to be doing something like that.
Well, firstly, I've never been in the police. So everyone says, oh, wow, he must have been in the police. We have a police cybercrime teams who I worked with, but I've actually been an investigator initially with Customs and Excise, in which I investigated effectively drug trafficking, not too dissimilar to Floor, any sort of significant international smuggling of drugs. I did that with Customs. I joined as a specialist investigator probably about 20 odd years ago. And then after seven years of doing that, I moved across to the Serious Organised Crime Agency, which was the precursor to the National Crime Agency in the UK. And it was there that I focused on cybercrime, and I was part of the first one of the first national cybercrime units in the UK under SOCA, and then subsequently moved into the National Cybercrime Unit with the National Crime Agency, initially as an investigator, and then subsequently helped develop and stand up the prevent programs, the cybercrime prevention program through the NCA.
How did you and Floor actually come to meet each other and come to work together?
Well, that is an interesting story, which I'll keep as brief as possible. But I mentioned that I got involved in the prevent team, and I became involved in prevent because it's really important to impress that the National Crime Agency, their primary focus is in what's called cyber-dependent crime. So they look at primarily individuals who have the aptitude and the skills to develop malicious software. So those who are able to develop it are completely different to those who are able to use it. Anyone can use it, you can use any, but developing it means you have to have an aptitude for coding, for programming, for writing scripts, for understanding the back end of digital technology. And this upstream approach from the National Crime Agency, where they looked at actually who is enabling people to do cybercrime, meant that our focus primarily worked on this particular group. And I found myself as an investigator arresting a disproportionate amount of people who were under 25 years old, which became quite a surprise to me, because most of the people are arrested for serious crime were in their late 30s and 40s. And so what I became interested in is, how do such young people get involved in cybercrime, especially this technical side? So with the prevent remit in hand, I managed to identify individuals who had come under the law enforcement radar and gone through the criminal justice system, which was at the time People in Anonymous and other types of groups like that, and get them to speak to me about their lives and not their criminality. And it was from there I identified some really key points where there were significant crossovers between the individuals I spoke to, and through that put together a pathway and then run it past some industry professionals within the ethical hacking industry, a group called CREST, and found that there was a connectivity between the root of those who did illegal hacking and those who did ethical hacking. And it was through that we started developing interventions and making representations to law enforcement colleagues abroad as well, because obviously cybercrime is borderless, and there is where I met Floor.
And that's very brief, guys. If you've never spoken to Greg, this is cybercrime and cyber prevention in a nutshell. You know, because I have a lot of very smart colleagues who are very driven to do what they're doing. They really want to reach end results, or really into digging into something. Whereas a lot of offenders that we arrest have the same attitude, the same passion for IT. They just seem to have taken a different turn in their life. And, you know, how can we make sure that people with an aptitude for IT take that positive turn in their life?
So Floor, maybe could you give our listeners a sense of just how big the problem is? How big a problem is the issue of cybercrime with young offenders?
Well, cybercrime is a growing problem. I think that is obvious. Like, young people seem to take a more and more role in those crimes. We in the Netherlands have seen that youth crime is dropping for years already, which is quite new. It's always been growing and now it's been dropping for years behind. And we see that cybercrime is rising. And I'm not sure if we can directly say that's because all the offenders who used to commit regular offenses, offline offenses, are now into cybercrime, but that is something that we assume.
And Greg, to the point that Floor made there, do you think the pandemic has compounded the fact that we may be seeing, you know, physical crimes being transferred over to the cyber world?
The landscape is so vast, the capability to police it is always going to be difficult. And that's why we, from offender prevention perspective, we put a lot of emphasis on ensuring that anybody who goes into that world or are interested in a digital technology and in maybe the more nefarious aspects are able to make an informed choice about the route that they take and where it could take them.
So from that as well, I know that Flo was saying from her experiences, you know, a lot of the individuals that you've been working with are sometimes unaware of the consequences sometimes of their actions. Do we find then that they have particular motivations in enacting these scenarios, or is it complete unawareness? What's been your experience?
I would say, so from talking to some of the more high profile individuals who have been caught up within law enforcement, primarily in the UK, for quite serious cybercrime, if they come to the attention of the National Crime Agency, it's invariably serious crime. One thing was clear was that they would know that at some stage that what they were doing was moving into a grey or into a darker area of the digital world. What they invariably did not know was the full implications of what they were doing. A responsible adult in a room will try and encourage, tailor, focus that individual's ability in some shape or form. Unless they have a digital interest and they have an understanding, then most parents are completely out of the loop. Most adults are out of the loop. If a kid shows you binary and some basic scripting, then you'll say, oh, my child's a genius, and leave them to get on with it.
And then, Floor, I'd actually like to unpack a little bit of what Gregory's just said. So, I mean, you've caught some juvenile cyber criminals, and there's actually a recent story where two British schoolboys, in this case, actually stole around $1 million worth of Bitcoin from a man in the US's digital wallet. And allegedly, or apparently, one's got to be careful with your wording here, their families have refused to hand it back. So, I mean, do you have some examples of stories that have stuck with you? And is there a typical story?
Well, I think that last question is a very good question. I don't think there is a typical story, but we see a lot of things that are similar in the way that they progress their cybercriminal career. But if we ask them how they started with this, you see that they all sort of have this same pathway into it. Where, for example, I can give you a few examples. One of the first cases that is still really in my mind when I do this work is a 70-year-old boy that was hacking into a major ISP in the Netherlands. By that time, we were not aware, of course, that it was a 17-year-old. All we knew that there was a big ISP that was in trouble. There was a real big problem in the Netherlands. So the National High Tech Crime Unit got, we got a phone call. We have to find out who is in the system. Somebody was inside of the critical systems of this ISP. And the investigation took us weeks. We had to fly to literally the other side of the world. We were following digital traces. At the end, ending up in a bedroom in the Netherlands somewhere of some 70-year-old who was still living with his parents. And, you know, there was so much damage. There was financial damage. There was all kind of damage to the company. And his motivation was that he wanted to watch free videos. So the comparison between the motivation and the damage that's being done is just different. It's just off. And we've also seen a lot of people who, for example, commit DDoS attacks on schools. That's quite common. And if you're asking, you know, what is the role of the parents? What's the role of the schools? Parents are sometimes aware of the fact that it's not okay to do this, I'm not sure how they perceive a DDoS attack, but it's just a way of making sure that the system cannot run anymore. And they might see it as mischief, but usually parents don't know that this is a criminal act that can make their kids end up in prison.
Some of our previous guests on season one of the podcast, specifically Bob Wigley and Jeff White, spoke about the role of parents and various things, specifically things like gaming. So Jeff White mentioned that gaming kind of was a sort of a gateway to cybercrime. You know, it usually started with hacking the game and getting the kind of the internal game currency, and then sort of expanded from there when they realized that this could actually be taken out into the real world. You know, what is the role of things like gaming in relation to cybercrime? And does this potentially encourage youngsters to, obviously not every youngster games would go into cybercrime, but the ones who try and hack the games, is this kind of a way to start a career in cybercrime?
That's a really good question. And I'll start with a rider. There's millions, if not billions, of people gaming. If gaming was a gateway into cybercrime, I suspect that we would know none of us would have any money in our banks. But what I can say is, from the debriefing of the individuals I spoke to and from the ongoing discussions that I've had within that community, gaming was always the beginning. And when I say gaming, it was mainly around the modifications and the cheats through games, understanding how they worked, which stimulated their interest. So they weren't so much interested in using these modifications or doing the or purchasing the modifications. They're interested in how they worked. They wanted to look at under the bonnet of the fast car as opposed to getting the car and riding. And so that stimulus of that environment meant that they went onto the forums that spoke about how to mod and how to cheat. And there, it's at that stage they realized that they had an aptitude for the coding and the programming and binary. As one of the youngsters who was 14 said to me, when I was 9 and I first saw binary, I could see all the patterns. And that stimulus, that continual stimulus, is how a number of them made the transition from an innocent practice such as gaming into modding and cheating and booting as well, how that was done, into hacking, and then off into a more criminal direction.
The solution could also be within the gaming industry, and that's why we are actively seeking cooperation with the gaming industry to see if they can help us to make sure that we warn people who might commit a crime within that gaming environment.
Floor, reading up on the steps in your career, one of the things that kind of stood out to me was the HackRight program. I understand this started about 3 years ago in the Netherlands, if I'm right. Are you able to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think it's 3 years now. HackRight is an intervention for first offenders in the age of 12 to 21 who committed a cybercrime. And it's basically restricted to people with a strong interest in IT, or at least have some capabilities within IT who are interested in doing more in that field. And in this program, offenders can learn why their acts are illegal, which sounds a bit weird if you compare it to other forms of punishment, because they're usually aware by then. And they also learn more about the consequences of their crimes. So, for example, what happens if you commit a DDoS attack? What happens behind the screens? What happens? Why is there so much financial damage related to it? And they also learn, and we think that's quite important, how they can use their IT skills in a more positive way. What is different for HackRight when you compare it to other forms of punishment is that the HackRight candidates, so the cyber criminals, are being coached by both a social worker and by somebody within the IT industry, because they both have different skills. They both have different sets of knowledge about how to make sure that that people don't reoffend. That's, of course, a specialization of the public workers. But they have basically very little understanding of the IT world. Like, for example, where exactly are the lines that somebody is crossing? When is hacking helpful? And when is hacking an illegal act that can even be a crime? So they're being coached by people with both backgrounds. And that combination, we believe, is a very effective way of preventing reoffending. To give you an example, we've had people who were just curious, seeing how far they could enter a certain system. We've dealt with a 14-year-old who broke into the website of a big car selling company because he was trying to help them. He really tried to see if the system was safe enough, and he really liked their cars, and he just tried to figure out, you know, how far can I get into the system? And when he got there, he sent them a warning note. He sent them an email, and I think he even gave them a call saying, you know, are you aware that your system is not safe? And I think the secretary of that company, she took that phone call, and she said, who am I talking to? A 14-year-old? What are you talking about? Our company is safe, and don't bother us anymore. And that's when he got really angry. So he decided to break into the email system and send an email to all the customers that the company went bankrupt. And that's when somebody filed a complaint. And that's when the real damage was being done. But this is happening. It's all, you know, if you understand the story behind it, you can understand why these kind of kids are suitable for a program like HackRight. If they would just, you know, do their time in prison, for example, the question is, would they reoffend again afterwards? They probably will, because nobody explained to them why exactly it's so bad what they did and how they could have reacted otherwise.
So I guess prevention is better than cure. So, I mean, these programs are amazing, and I'd love to get into them in a little bit more detail. But Greg, maybe if you can also just touch on something. You helped Fleur in setting up a new program in the Netherlands, the Cyber Offender Prevention Squad. Or COPS, as it's known. It's targeting young people at risk of committing cybercrimes before they break the law rather than after. I mean, what learnings from your previous role in the British police and the British experience have you brought to the Netherlands?
The more information you can provide about cybercrime at the earliest stages of anyone's involvement in the digital world, the less likely you are to have rising numbers of low-level cybercrime that could move into more serious cybercrime. And that's what I learned from the UK, that actually, by the time that we became aware of someone's illegality, their criminal activity, they had already progressed through a series of stages in which they had no interventions. So the work that I did with the agency in prevention was to identify as early as possible individuals who may be on that pathway, and then to build in interventions such as an AdWord campaign where we would use keywords to say, if someone's saying, how do I boot? How do I get hold of a remote access tool? They're between a certain age range, that they get a warning saying, look, just be aware that what you're doing is a contravention of the Computer Misuse Act, and then redirects them elsewhere. We'd also do things like cease and desist, in which we would identify young people who have committed activities that are invariably related to a high-level law enforcement operation, like the taking down of a criminal website. These individuals may have registered. They may have been involved in low-level purchases, and we would work with law enforcement to go and visit these individuals, give them a letter, make them aware that we know what they were doing and what they're inquiring about. Most importantly, make their parents aware, who invariably fall off the chair because they don't have a clue. And what we found is that with interventions like that, where there is a tangible contact with law enforcement, the recidivism rate, the reoffending rate, tends to be a lot less because the perception of risk is raised. Whereas nothing normally happens, what we try and say is get in there early, get some sort of intervention in, get to these houses, make them aware that actually law enforcement is doing something for these entry-level activities, and this is who you're connected to, and let the parent know that the FBI and the NCA and the Dutch National Police have just arrested someone who their child has just been involved in the same website, in the same activity at a lower level. And it's proving to be quite impactive.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We always like to end our episodes by asking our guests three simple questions. What are you reading or listening to at the moment? Is there anything you'd recommend for our listeners?
Sure, two that I would recommend. One's a very short report called the Cyber Criminal Career Pathway Report, which you could Google. You could get a copy offline. It's free. And it's produced by the National Crime Agency and by CREST. And it will just give you an insight into much of the rationale for the work we do in offender prevention. The other one is an excellent book done by an eminent Oxford University professor called Jonathan Lusthouse. And the book is called Industry of Anonymity. And it looks at the business end of cybercrime and also the human factors. So it's a really interesting read, and it will give you some real insight into the stimulus and motivations of certain types of cyber criminals and how we could invest more time in actually understanding these human factors as opposed to just the technical ones on what they do as opposed to why they do it.
Wow, definitely take a note of those two. And Fleur, what are you reading or listening to at the moment? Is there anything that you'd recommend for our listeners?
Well, actually, I just finished a book called Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. And I don't know if you know him. He's quite known outside of the Netherlands as well. What I find really interesting about his book is that he gathered a lot of scientific evidence about people and human behavior. And what he points out is that most people are behaving well, and people that do bad aren't necessarily bad. They just do bad things. And the reasons why they do bad things are very various, but they all strive to do something good, mostly. It's circumstances, it's all kind of reasons that turn them into doing bad stuff. And I think why I think it's an interesting read is that it gives you another perspective also on criminals. Because many people who read into the newspapers about criminals, they all imagine some really bad person who's completely bad from the inside. But when you interview these people and when you hear about their history and about how they ended up committing crime, you hear such interesting stories. And it really makes you realize it could be anyone. It could be you.
I think you raise a really interesting point there, Flora, and definitely one for our listeners to kind of take on board. And regarding the programs that you guys are doing, the work that you guys are doing, where can our listeners hear more about that?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because we don't have our own website. and we have web pages on the police. But one of the things that might be interesting to explore is the website changeyourgame.com. It's a website that we designed for youngsters in the Netherlands, where they can explore their talents, where they can do all kinds of challenges, but where they can also read more about the laws online and about what happens if you do cross those lines.
Looking into the future, this time next year, you know, where do you think we're going to be with this type of juvenile cybercrime? I'll start with you, Greg.
In a year's time, I'd like to see that there are a number of other law enforcement agencies across the globe that are part of this offender prevention network. And I'm involved with international partners and agencies with the Dutch National Police to socialize that across law enforcement in Europe and across the globe.
Thank you so much to you both for joining us today. It's been a real, real pleasure having you guys with us. As I say, Brian and I have been fighting each other to ask all of our questions because we've just had so many. I think the programs you guys are running are absolutely fascinating and a huge lesson for everybody. I know I've definitely taken things away from this, and I know our listeners will have as well. So Flora and Greg, thank you so, so much for taking the time to speak with us today. And we will definitely be having you back if you have time to come and speak with us again.
One last word before I go. I always leave with one last word. One last nugget, as I like to say to my colleagues. From my experience, law enforcement see the problem, but actually society needs to own it, because we can't resolve the problem. It has to be a collective effort between the private and public sector, with investment in the same resources that you have for any youngster anywhere replicated for the online world. Coding clubs, technical clubs, they should be on our doorstep and accessible for every parent who is bemused by their child's interest in the digital world.
Definitely. I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much to you both for joining us today. And thank you also to all of our listeners for joining us on this week's Fizzy Business. It's really been a pleasure having you with us. If you have enjoyed our podcast today, please do leave us a review for us on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you're hearing this. And feel free to follow us on our Twitter page @Mimecast for more information. Until next time.